50 points for decent gains to the Nasdaq and the S&P at the close, ringing the bell here at the New York Stock Exchange.
Fears of a possible trade war that might be sparked by President Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs.
So I would think that if we start to get a trade war, that it'll put pressure on the Fed to be more cautious on raising rates.
Black swans, I think, were about things you can't see coming. The tariffs were something that you could see coming because it had been talked about. It was a known unknown. We just didn't know what they were going to do. Now we know what they're going to do.
Your point about a black swan event, I mean, if this thing boils over into a full-blown trade war, and I would add that I don't think this is about China. I think this is more about NAFTA and sending a warning shot to Mexico and Canada, our two biggest trading partners.
This is one way to get some of these countries' attention.
Well, it's got everybody's attention, that's for sure.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
It was another volatile week for the stock market this week as the new Fed chairman testified on Capitol Hill before the House and Senate. And the market took the Fed chairman's words to mean that the Fed may be getting hawkish and maybe raise rates even more. On top of that, we have the beginning of a possible trade war as the Trump administration talks about slapping 25% tariffs on steel. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Gary Dorsch will be joining me. Gary's a little cautious right now as he takes a look at the market. He does see one sector that is doing very well. Whether you look at days the market goes down or when the market bounces back, you want to hear what he has to say about that, and especially about commodities, oil, and gold. Also, Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman will be joining me. Mark's still bullish on the dollar, but he's buying beaten up stocks. You want to hear why. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here to talk about what moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
Don't you know it's not nice to bully stocks? Hi, I'm John Loeffler, and boy, was it another volatile week. I mean, after all, we started the year on a positive note following 2 years of really relative calm, but wow, volatility has returned with a vengeance, and it started this week on Tuesday with Fed Chair Jerome Powell's testimony on Capitol Hill. He testified both on Tuesday and Thursday, his first since assuming that position, and the markets didn't like some of the Fed chair's comments. So we'll take a look at exactly what his testimony did and how the market reacted and how that is going to affect investment, as well as anticipation, of course, of more interest rate hikes this year. We're going to touch on oil markets as well, because there's a lot of complacency in the oil market. People don't seem to be too concerned about spikes right now, but given the geopolitical, especially geopolitical and other risks, that may be a misplaced complacency. So that'll be the second part today. All of that on the big picture in the Financial Sense News Hour. And we give a big hearty welcome back to Ryan Poplava to talk about the drivers, the catalysts that drove the market this week. Well, what are your thoughts on the recent correction this week? Things got a little exciting on Friday there for a while.
Yeah, I mean, volatility is definitely here. One of the idioms we've been kind of thinking about for the a lot more flexible traders is, you know, buy the dip, sell the rally, is the kind of the environment that we're in. If you look at this correction, it was definitely a factor on Thursday, you know, concerning the tariff issue with Trump announcing on steel and aluminum. But on the correction side of things, things really got kicked off a little earlier in the week, about the time the new Federal Reserve Chairman, Jerome Powell, took the testimonial chair before Congress. He spoke on Tuesday and then again on Thursday. And when I looked at his comments, a lot of his opening remarks, they're right in step with comments Janet Yellen had made in the past, essentially just keeping the momentum going there. Expect further rate hikes at a gradual pace as the outlook for the economy looks balanced. But it was his comments actually later that his economic projections had strengthened since the December meeting that prompted the market to do a little bit of a hiccup. When that about occurred, the market started correcting, and One of the things that we were taking a look at was what were the market's projections for a fourth rate hike. Those expectations actually went up from the previous day. It was only just 24.4%, so about 25%. That went to 33% after his comments on Tuesday. We saw Treasury yields were pushed back up to the highs we saw last week. And when Powell came back again on Thursday to talk to the Senate Banking Committee, he said a number of things, but really none of them were new and none of it was really unexpected. So it was mainly his comments that his economic projections had strengthened since December that kind of caused the market to think, whoa, are we looking at more than three rate hikes? Or are we looking at four? And then, of course, technicals were partly to blame as well for the movements and the steepness of the corrections, especially in the last hour on Wednesday. We saw the S&P 500 fall below its 50-day moving average, an average that has been widely watched over the past few weeks because we've dipped below it, came back above it on, I think, Friday at the close last week. And that prompted some buying on Monday. So definitely got to be watching that 50-day moving average right now because that's what everyone else is doing.
Okay, what about the announcement of the steel and aluminum tariff, which was announced on Thursday? Did that exacerbate any of the selling this week?
It did. When the market started reversing, I was combing through some of the wires to see what was going on. This was actually on Tuesday. I stopped every now and then to look at what Powell was saying, but it's pretty long testimony. Looking at what actually was happening at the time, about 15 to 20 minutes into the market reversing, Trump's trade policy agenda was released. And the main word I saw used to describe it was protectionism. So yes, definitely on Thursday, I mean, we had dipped below the 50-day moving average already. So the announcement of this later the day on Thursday did cause some accelerated selling. And I read some of the commentary that some of the blame was on the bullish comments from Powell about his projections, as I mentioned, but definitely Trump's announcement, that was a big issue. That was the third consecutive day of negative closes for the market. Stocks opened down another 1% on Friday, actually, but found some buying interest after, having already done 3 days of consecutive selling to close positive with a rally that was driven mainly in small cap stocks. The Russell 2000 closed up, I think, 1.7% or more. The reason being, primarily what you see in the small cap index are U.S. operating companies, and those have little exposure to trade issues. So definitely at the end of this week, trade was the big topic. And of course, even the small U.S. operating companies, they don't really have a lot of exposure to this unless, of course, foreign countries start fighting back with measures of their own. And you should also note that the auto industry didn't actually react all too well on Thursday to the thoughts of, higher steel and aluminum prices that could essentially eat away at some of their profit margins.
Yeah, the funny thing about tariffs, I guess you could say it's about taxes as well. They never go quite the way you want them to go. I mean, there's always some unintended consequences, and the market starts shucking and jiving, trying to accommodate itself, or in some cases to dodge the consequences of what is put in place. And then going from a trade accommodative stance to a trade competitive stance, the consumer never benefits. So anyway, what were some of the key statements from Chair Powell this week? Because we did have testimony on two different days. Does he think inflation is here? Did he drop any faux pas moments in the testimony like Janet Yellen did regarding biotech valuations?
No, he mainly kept the company line in tow. He said that fiscal policy had meaningfully added to demand or that it can based on the tax bill. But he also said that it could add to pressures of inflation. But it is hard, he said, to kind of pinpoint accurately exactly how it's going to affect inflation. But he's definitely said it's a factor, but not really a driver. He agreed we're at or beyond full employment. That came up a couple of times. Participation rate was also discussed. That has been declining. He said a lot of that is structural, and he's found that that's actually been declining for decades. And I heard him say on Tuesday that inflation has ticked up, but not decisively. He believes that rates are largely up due to positive global outlook. So the big one that we saw was that he said it's not the Fed's job to help or hurt the stock market. And, of course, there was some political grandstanding, but I thought he handled his position very respectfully. It was a great start for him.
Yeah, and you never know how it's going to be. I mean, we've been through so many in the past anyway. Okay, this is it's not the merry month of May. What is it? What do we call it? The wintry month of March.
March
something
Madness.
Like that. March Madness. There we go. I know that the East Coast is really taking it in terms of a storm right now this weekend. And we like to hit some of the major economic news this week. So what can you tell us were some of the notable announcements?
Yeah, definitely quite a few. Of course, at the end of a month, we get the very key Purchasing Managers Index data. That's quite leading in what we watch and view. And if you look at some of the numbers that came out, there was a slight dip in activity, but overall, you know, these numbers are in very positive territory, expansion territory. Any kind of number that's above 50 is a expansion number. And so Eurozone dropped to 58.6 from 59.6, so very small dip there. But I did note in the commentary that the expansion activity is seen in really all countries covered. So very broad-based growth. I think Germany, Netherlands, and France were at the top of the heap on their growth rates, but definitely a great place for them right now. The JP Morgan Global Manufacturing PMI dropped for the second month down to 54.2, but it's still one of the best readings since early 2011. The PMI growth in China, while barely in expansionary territory, which was right around 51.6, it's still considered improving. And another key metric here was the U.S. Purchasing Managers Index, which showed strong growth. But interestingly, inside some of the numbers, we noticed that there was an increase in input and output price inflation, reaching essentially multi-year highs. Business confidence is high, with support for widespread job creation. So overall, economics look really good. We did get some housing data. We can maybe talk about that a little bit. Pending home sales dropped about 4.7% in January, and construction spending was flat, about 0%, clearly. Prices continue to rise, with the FHFA housing price index was up about 0.3% in December. And then there's the Case-Shiller 20 city index that was up 6.3% in December, following another really big increase, I believe, in November. The takeaway is that high prices are definitely here, and they do continue to rise on a whole. Higher mortgage rates are starting to slow activity, as those high prices are as well, which could possibly down the road hurt the overall growth of the economy. Obviously, we saw that in 2005, 6, and 7. So definitely something that we should be watching.
And also, it looks like the ISM Manufacturing Index hit a new recent high in the 60s again at 60.8. So all in all, the economic activity continues to be solid for the U.S. and globally speaking. And it sounds like we're going to need to continue to watch the real estate market for any slowdown high prices and higher rates could cause going forward. So Ron Poplava, thank you for the commentary, and we'll look forward to reviewing it again next week.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting. We continue to have some earnings reports. I didn't get to talk about that too much, but we did see some retail companies like TJX, and I believe Macy's also post good numbers and higher guidance. So we're at the tail end now of the fourth quarter earnings season. Heading forward, you know, the big issue we're going to be talking about quite a bit now is trade wars, and to see what kind of reaction we get from China. China said something like, you know, they're not impressed. So, you know, where we go from here is going to be very interesting in hearing what they have to say, or what kind of responses they have to the protectionism that we're seeing here in the U.S.
Yep, should be. All right, Ryan Poplava, see you next week.
See you next week, John.
Everyone loves the stock market when it's going up. Making money in the markets, when you think about it, seems easy, which it is when you're in the middle of a bull market. But stocks, as you well know, don't always go up. And there are times when they can go down, in fact, go down a lot, which is why you need to have an investment strategy to help you navigate the good times along with the bad. Not everyone has an investment strategy, and quite honestly, many of you don't. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. We can put together an investment strategy to help you navigate those volatile investment markets in good times and bull markets and the bear markets that follow.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
98 years to start when a Czech playwright wrote a play called Rossum's Universal Robots, and he gave the new word robot to the language. And people really got fascinated by the idea that man could create machines that would do man's jobs for them. But people thought of robots before as the kind of ones that took away jobs from factory workers. No, these robots were taking away jobs from investment professionals of all kinds, analysts, portfolio managers, salespeople. A little personal example was my operation. I've been in this business a long time. We had to close down because our clients were entirely portfolio managing people, and they just said that they had lost so much revenue from their clients going to index funds.
Well, volatility has returned once again to the stock market. Almost after a year and a half of calm in the markets, well, storms are upon us, and this week was another storm. Joining us on the program is Gary Dorsch from Sir Charts-a-Lot. Gary, let's begin with the stock market. We had a big pullback at the beginning of February, had a nice bounce back, but here we are, back in corrective territory again. So as you view the market, is this the beginning of something more serious, or is this simply another correction, and is the possibility that we've already peaked in the stock market?
Well, today is March 2nd, and 1 week from today, exactly 1 week from today, will be 9 years since this great bull market began. That's when we hit all-time bottom, and from the Great Recession lows of March 9th of 2009, 9 years is therefore the second longest bull market in history, and if it can continue to stay on its upward trajectory between now and August, it'll be the longest bull market in history. So point is, it's an aging bull market with gray hairs, and it's in its late retirement years. And yet last year we saw an incredible vigor and strength even in its old age, something that normally you won't expect to see for such a long-term bull market. But that may have very well been what is called a euphoria mania phase, which is typically what we see at the tail end of great bull markets. Those who resisted investing for all those years capitulate and start throwing in their money, usually retail investors. And we saw a lot of that in December and January as they plowed in over $100 billion of retail money into stock mutual funds. That was taken as signal by contrarians that we were near the end of this great bull market. And of course, we had violent moves in early February. We had 2 days where the Dow Industrials dropped by more than 1,000 points in a single day. We saw the third flash crash in history where the Dow dropped as much as 1,600 points. So considering that last year, the S&P only had 8 trading days of the whole year where it moved up or down more than 1% in a single day, we've already doubled that just from the beginning of February until today. So volatility has come back with a vengeance. Volatility is a code word on Wall Street for heavy selling, and it's no longer, therefore, going to be an escalator ride, as you have aptly described this previous rally. It's not going to be a steady escalator ride upwards now. It's going to be more of a violent, bumpy, two-way market. And we have two major forces as I see it right now. On the buy side, the S&P 500 companies have trillions of dollars at their disposal from overseas, at least about a half a dozen of these companies, mostly concentrated in the hands of maybe 10 companies. But they are going to use this money from overseas to buy back their own stock. And already there is estimates from Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan that the S&P 500 companies may spend anywhere from $650 to $800 billion this year on buybacks. That's what I call corporate QE. Corporations buying back their own stock are the biggest buyers and defenders of this market. But this year, unlike previous years, if you're buying the market, you'll be fighting the Fed. And I think the Fed is going to continue on its gradual path of raising interest rates and, more importantly, continuing on with quantitative tightening and allowing about $420 billion of its bonds to roll off its balance sheet here in 2018. And if they were to continue next year, that would be a $600 billion drain through quantitative tightening next year. And so the combined effects of the Fed rate hikes and QT this year would drain over $700 billion because rate hikes do require drainage of short-term money to sustain the higher rates. And at the same time, the European Central Bank will be exiting from QE at the end of September. They've already cut their QE injections in half. The only central bank left will be the Bank of Japan. And earlier this morning, the Bank of Japan signaled that they would consider exiting from QE sometime next year. And between now and then, we may see a stealth tapering of QE injections from the Bank of Japan.
At what point, you just brought up something that I think is very valid here with the tax cuts and the repatriation of cash. Corporations, which have been a powerful force in this bull market, now have a lot more cash to, let's say, buy back their own stock. And of course, you see these corrections as we had in February, now in March. Lower stock prices allows them to buy back more shares with that money. So my point is, at what point do we see interest rates rise where it puts a check to this stock market and even corporate buying? Because at some point when things are going to head into a bear market, even corporations start conserving cash.
Well, the day the S&P closed at its all-time highs on January 26th at around 2874, that was the day where the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield penetrated 2.65%. And that's a key level because that was last year's highest level of the year. So once the 10-year took out last year's high, the computer algorithms set off the alarms, and that put them into sell mode in the stock market. So to answer your question, we're already in danger territory because having taken out last year's high at 2.65 and moving up to 2.95, down to about 2.85 today, I think was the main trigger which touched off the selling in the stock market. Once the interest rates kind of stalled out and leveled off for a week or so, it allowed for the recovery of the stock markets. But now fears of higher interest rates, again, was largely behind this week's sell-off. We saw the Dow Industrial Futures drop as much as 1,600 points from Tuesday morning until Friday morning, March 2nd, and the S&P futures dropping 140 points over just the four-day period. It's remarkable volatility. I think we can maybe just go a little further with your question, and what would happen if the 10-year yield goes above 3%? And what would happen if it goes up to 3.25 to 3.5? Because that's ultimately where this is all going to have to come down to. This is where people are going to have to figure out what will be the reaction to the stock market when we see interest rates go higher. And I think it's inevitable that interest rates will go higher. Last time we spoke 2 months ago, first week of January, the 10-year was at 2.45, and I predicted it would go to 3 to 3.25. Sticking with that prediction and may even edge it up a little bit to 3.25 to 3.5. The amount of debt that this Treasury is going to have to sell is staggering, about $1 trillion a year for each of the next few years. And how are we going to be able to finance the debt? It's going to require foreign money, and the only way to bring foreign money into this country, the Fed will have to raise short-term rates to keep the dollar steady. And so we're now caught in a trap of their own making. The market went up on the positive aspects of the tax cuts, and we all know what the positives are. And now we're going to start to see the negative implications of these massive tax cuts in the form of $1 trillion budget deficits for as far as the eye can see, and much higher interest rates. And if interest rates go significantly higher, it'll completely negate the benefits of these tax cuts, and the market's going to have a very tough time with that.
I want to move on to something that is maybe even driving interest rates with this economic growth and stimulus. There's the fear that inflation is going to heat up as the economy does, and the stimulus is applied. We're seeing signs of that, whether it's falling dollar, and of course now we have a possible trade war with tariffs. I want to talk about the commodity sector, Gary. In particular, I want to talk about energy. I want to talk about gold and the base metals.
I normally look at commodities as a key indicator, a lead indicator of where inflation is going. I don't totally trust government statistics, and I don't think anyone else should when it comes to inflation. I think they're deliberately manipulated and fudged to the downside. But we can see commodity prices, and that's something that is hard to deny. Right now, the equally weighted commodity index is unchanged from a year ago. But if it continues to move upwards, it'll be the first signs that inflation is coming back. Weighing down on the commodity sector was the grains, which were quite weak for quite some time, but we're starting to see now shortages of grains from South America putting upward pressure on corn and soybeans. So the only negative sector in the commodities is now joining the rest, which have been moved into positive territory. On the oil market, U.S. oil supplies at record highs, 10.25 million barrels a day, and projected to hit 11 million barrels a day by the end of the year. So that is keeping a lid on the market. And for quite some time now, the December 2018 and 2019 crude oil contracts have traded at $4 to $8 a barrel discounts to the spot market. And they're still in that bearish mode. They are basically saying that the U.S. will be able to keep a lid on oil prices over the course of the rest of this year. On the positive side for crude oil, they have growing global demand with the global population, and OPEC and Russia still holding to their agreements.
What about Venezuela, where you've seen production drop by 800,000? It's projected by another 300,000. What about the geopolitical element outside the increasing demand?
Good point. Venezuela's, as you mentioned, oil production down 800,000 barrels. I think Mexico, natural depletion of about 200,000. So, you know, these are the counterbalancing forces. Venezuela, of course, is a basket case, and it could be total chaos and maybe a complete shutdown at some point. I think there's also a geopolitical chance of an outright war in the Middle East could occur sometime this year in Syria between Iran and Israel and Russia and possibly the United States. So that to me would be the biggest risk on a geopolitical level. Got very close to a major altercation just a few weeks ago there. So that is also supporting the market. But overall, I would have to sort of be neutral on crude oil, looking between 60 and 66 a barrel for the next several months for U.S. oil prices because of these various factors we discussed. Typically, the geopolitical events or black swan events, they don't occur very often. So I'm basically neutral on the oil market. The inflation in the U.S. will come from the tax cuts, putting more money in people's hands. There'll be some increase in wages, and this is enough for the Fed to continue with tightening. Once again, the Fed has to get this debt financed. It'll require foreign money, and for the most part, the Fed has to raise interest rates to be able to attract enough money from overseas. And so it's pretty much locked onto this course.
Gary, what about gold? It's been struggling. It's been trying to, you know, get above that 1360 level. Here we are on this Friday. It's down around 1300. You would think with rising inflation, rising geopolitical tensions, as you mentioned, not to mention the fact that Russia just announced yesterday that they have new ballistic missiles that can penetrate U.S. defenses. That's on top of coming up with a new ballistic missile submarine that's undetectable. So what about these geopolitical forces and turbulence? We just haven't seen gold move in this market.
Well, the gold market is certainly fickle. It changes its focus of attention from one variable to the other. For the longest time, it was held hostage to the direction of U.S. interest rates. As U.S. interest rates were going up, the price of gold stayed down or declined. Then it decided to break away from the interest rate stranglehold and went up with the euro, the British pound, the Canadian dollar, and then simply became just another currency versus the U.S. dollar. Right now, it's in that mode where it's tracking the direction of the major reserve currencies against the U.S. So as the euro goes higher, gold has been going higher. I would imagine, though, if the Fed continues on with the tightening liquidity this year, that's sort of a big if, because you never know if they'll get cold feet if the stock market was to drop more than 10% from its previous record high and go into deeper correction territory if the Fed would get scared and get cold feet and stop this whole tightening mode. But until that time, the Fed will be on this path. And that should be at least supportive to the dollar, and it's going to put a ceiling over the price of gold at $1,350. The only currency that may appreciate somewhat would be the Japanese yen. If traders get the notion that the Bank of Japan is going to do some stealth tapering and reduce its QE injections over the course of the rest of this year, but still a hefty amount, but less than we see now. So the yen may be the one currency that can go higher. And if the European Central Bank does mothball its QE injections in a few months at the end of September, that would be beneficial for the euro. And they'll sort of be in this range where you got these counterbalancing forces between all the three central banks sort of restricting liquidity. The gold market, therefore, I think, if liquidity is restricted, will not do well in that environment. It'll do well to just hold relatively steady. I would see support around 1275 and resistance at 1350.
So, Gary, your best guess, given the headwinds that we have, rates are rising, inflation is rising. If you were to take a best guess, let's just say taking a look at the next 6 months, given what the Fed is doing, and then also talking about this just freshet of money coming from overseas with the repatriation of cash, will that be enough to overcome the headwinds of rising interest rates and give us a higher market?
Well, we see the rebound from the February 9th low. The NASDAQ 100 went back to the all-time highs, and the technology sector made slightly new highs this week. So I've come to the conclusion, if you're a stock market investor, you should just be in the tech sector, and the rest of the market is lagging far behind. Tech goes down the least when the markets go down, and it goes up the most when the markets go up. We're seeing more and more of shifting into high tech, which is not a good sign of only one sector becoming bigger and bigger as part of the overall pie. But to answer your question, if my projection is right that the 10-year will go into 3.25 to 3.5, I think the stock market will drop. We would retest the lows of February 9th and knock those lows out if that interest rate does go up to 3.25, 3.5. I think there's a very high chance that that will occur for the interest rates. As I said, the amount of debt is just staggering, and the buybacks are once again concentrated in the hands of just maybe 10 companies for the most part, and those are mostly in the tech sector. And that's why you're seeing these great divergences within the market itself. So if you're an investor, tech is where you want to be, and the rest of the market will not do as well on the upside or the downside.
Well, listen, Gary, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so, please.
Well, my website is globalmoneytrends.com. You can go there to take a look and look at some of the articles I posted there. I also write a weekly newsletter published Friday afternoon after the close of the market with charts that are generally not available elsewhere on the markets and give a good overview, explanation of what's happening in the world. And so you can find me at globalmoneytrends.com.
Do you know what everyone wants? Everyone wants the ability to retire and live well. Sounds easy, but it isn't. It requires careful planning. That is something that everyone knows how to do, and you may need help to plan, implement, and monitor your progress, assessing where you are now and where you want to be in the future. That is where Financial Sense Advisors can help. And unlike many advisors who sell you products you don't need, at Financial Sense Advisors, we are fiduciaries, which means we put your interest first. We do well when you do well.
Call Financial Sense Advisors now and let us help you to make the change from just retiring to thriving in retirement. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. Again, that's 888-486-3939. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at FinancialSense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff. He's the William Fairfield Warren Professor at Boston University. Professor, you have studied Social Security. You have come up with some plans and recommendations about what should be done to fix the system. Let's begin with that, because 70% of the government's budget goes to Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt. How do we keep the system secure when its administrator says it's due to run out of money somewhere between 2027 and 2033?
Yeah, let me just correct that statement about the 70%. I think it also includes Medicaid and other entitlement programs like Obamacare subsidies. So anyway, it's a big number, 70%. We're kind of committed to the way we deal with Social Security going broke, and it's absolutely broke. It's in far, far worse shape than the Detroit pensions when they brought Detroit to bankruptcy. The system, those pension plans were about 20% underfunded. They were short about 20% of the money they needed to pay the benefits. Social Security has told us that they're 32% underfunded. They told us that back in July in their annual trustees report. The amount of money that we're short is $34 trillion. That's, you know, like more than 1.5 times official government debt of $20 trillion. So $34 trillion is the off-the-books debt that the government has been hiding from us. And you can't cure this problem by ignoring it. And that's what all the politicians have been doing. And it's not just the Republicans, but also the Democrats.
Well, the dollar has been falling steadily since January, but recently has begun to rally on prospects of higher interest rates in the U.S. Will this rally continue, or will the dollar fall? Joining us from Brown Brothers Harriman is Mark Chandler. Mark, let's talk about the dollar. The surprising thing, it began to fall last January. At the time, the Fed was in the process of raising interest rates three times. What was behind that decline?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, sometimes maybe the, you know, it's hard to trade in, like, trying to anticipate the future, but we also disagree with maybe what happens in the past. And so my understanding of the dollar sell-off in 2017 was that it really began in April. And that is to say the dollar was very strong in 2016, corrected, traded sideways for the first quarter of 2017. But then something happened, which wasn't in the United States. It had to do with France. It had to do with the fact that after the Brexit referendum in 2016, the election of Trump in 2016, many people thought this populist wave was going to sweep across Europe in a series of elections last year. And it became clear that it was not going to take place. That when this became clear, especially in France and the Netherlands, in late April, the euro gapped higher in late April and never looked back. And so I think that this was what the election did was it began the process of adjustment of positions, especially of short-term, medium-term momentum traders and trend followers. And then in October, November, the dollar recovered. Not fully, of course, but the dollar showed greater strength. And then as we ended in, as we got into further into November and December, the dollar came off partly, I think, because of the political noise and the fact that the dollar was falling, and that sort of bred more dollar sales. My own view, I'm more bullish a dollar. I haven't given up, though last year was difficult for me. You know, that book I wrote back in 2009 forecasted a big dollar recovery, and I'm hesitant to give up on that because I look at two things. One is the policies in the U.S., and I think that over time, wider interest rate differentials will make it painful to be short the U.S. dollar. And secondly, so this is more of a technical issue, is that after a big, say, dollar rally in beginning in 2014, middle of 2014, lasting till early last year, how much did the back of that rally before we say it's in a bear market? And so I think that we came close to those levels that would have indicated we were changing trends for the dollar, but it stopped. And the key level I point out to you here would be 126 to 127 in the euro. We stopped at about 125.50. And now we're trading a little bit below 122.
Mark, you know, what really surprised me last year is the Fed, for the first time, was able to raise interest rates three times. And this year, it's anticipated three or maybe more. As I look at yields here and in Japan a 10-year note is, what, 4 basis points. And I look in Europe, Germany's 10-year is a little over 60 basis points. And then you look at treasuries, 10-year is almost close to 2.9. So you would think on the surface that would strengthen the dollar. But I read somewhere that because of the dollar's fall, the hedging cost for a lot of institutional investors overseas overcome the yield spread. Do you buy that?
Yeah, I think there is something to it. I mean, typically, you know, when people buy equities, they typically do not hedge their currency. Though, of course, there's plenty of products out there for investors to hedge currency exposure with the equities. But for the most part, it doesn't take place. Instead, where the hedging is more important is in the fixed income space. And that sort of makes sense because the key to total return in the fixed income space, the currency makes up a very large role. It's the key to total return. Because your yield is fixed as soon as you buy the bond, and the capital gains or appreciation doesn't really matter if you're going to hold it to maturity. So I do think there's something to that, that costs more, that when the Japanese buy U.S. treasuries or Europeans buy U.S. treasuries, they have to also think about the cost of hedging. But there's other things going on, too. And I think that if you tell me that the U.S. is further ahead, 2 hikes in 2015, 2016 combined, 3 hikes last year. We got 5 hikes behind us. A lot of economic data suggesting we're in a late cycle, late part of the business cycle. Europe seems to be in an earlier spot. They're still easing policy. So which equity markets would you prefer? And I think that equity markets, flows went into the European equities. And I think also what people are playing for, they know that the ECB is buying bonds in Europe. And so what a lot of fund managers are doing is they're buying the peripheral European bonds like Italy or Spain, Portugal, in anticipation that the ECB is still going to be buying, and so that they will, they have sort of the officials at their back. In addition to that, I think in the bigger picture, what people are thinking, if we do have a global synchronized recovery, which in my own work, by the way, I kind of think is maybe a little bit of a 2017 story, less of a 2018 story, but in any event, many people still think that we're in this synchronized global recovery. What's the best way to play it? Where do you get the biggest bang for the buck? And what investors have decided, European stocks aren't nearly as overvalued as U.S. stocks. Secondly, I think they prefer emerging market equities, which you've got a bigger bang for the buck despite the Fed raising interest rates. Emerging market stocks were up almost a third last year. And so I think that as people look at the world and they say, okay, got this synchronized global upturn, slow Fed raising interest rates, where do I get the biggest bang for my buck? Not in treasuries. It's not in U.S. equities. So I think that is in the capital flow story. It might have limited the dollar's ability to rally. But that's even a bigger issue here is look at what's happened. Japan and the Eurozone have large current account surpluses. That is to say, they are selling the world more goods than they're buying from the world. They're accumulating savings. If they don't buy foreign assets with those savings, their currencies go up. The U.S. has a trade deficit, a large trade deficit, even when you incorporate into that the improvement in the energy balance of trade. We've got a worsening trade balance. The U.S. needs to import capital. When it doesn't import the capital, the dollar sells off. The U.S. is not importing enough capital yet, and at a higher interest rate, I think it will.
Let's throw out something else there. You have the Fed, which is getting rid of some of its balance sheet. It's winding it down. And then there's a story that was in the Wall Street Journal this week, Mark, that the Japanese have been pulling out of treasuries going into Europe, and the Chinese have been buying less or selling treasuries. Are those stories having an impact here on the dollar? Obviously, if they're dumping their securities, that would put some weakness on the dollar.
Yes, you would think so, but maybe it's a question of who are they selling them to. So, for example, when the Chinese were experiencing capital outflows and their reserves were falling, which means that the treasury holdings were falling, this is 2015 story. The dollar was strong. The treasury market did very well. Remember, the 10-year yield got down to, almost 2% last September. We're up 90 basis points since then. And is that I want to say that the Chinese were buying treasuries last year. I think they bought the most in several years. The Japanese are letting their treasuries unwind a little bit. For me, I'd say that the private sector flows are much bigger than these central bank reserve management. And for me, the key here is this is one of the reasons I love foreign exchange, Jim. Foreign exchange market daily turnover is over $5 trillion a day. When we talk about the Japanese or the Chinese selling treasuries, we're talking about a fraction of that, and of course offset in part by higher oil prices, which means that OPEC countries have been buying more treasuries. So I'd want to look at the whole kit and caboodle, if you will, and the best place to look for some of this stuff is the IMF's website. They track this reserve holdings, called COFER, COFER. And the other thing you should know is that on the 15th of every month, roughly the 15th, the U.S. Treasury reports the international capital flow data. And this is where people get the idea that Japan or China have been selling treasuries while maybe OPEC's been a decent buyer of them.
Mark, let's talk about something else. We're getting a bit of a correction here in the markets with the testimony of the new Fed chairman on Capitol Hill. The markets walked away that the new Fed chairman seemed to be a little bit more hawkish, anticipating 4 rate hikes this year. Where do you stand? Will the Fed go 3, 4 or more, or maybe even the possibility even less?
Here's how I sort of see it. One is the market now is only pricing in 3 hikes. I don't hear anything Powell said to make it sound like that the 4 hikes is going to become policy. I think of it as a tactical issue. So you're the Federal Reserve. You're being criticized for overpromising and under-delivering. You're the new Federal Reserve chair. At your very first meeting, that's next month, you're able to raise interest rates. So do you have to double up on your hawkishness by also putting a fourth rate hike in? What is the downside? The downside is if the Fed only delivers 3 hikes and at your first meeting, its first chair meeting for the forecast, you move it up to 4, you only deliver 3, and now you're back in the old problem of the Fed, over-promising, under-delivering. I think strategically, tactically, June would probably be a better framework to change that rate hike. But even then, I'd say it doesn't really have to be changed until maybe September. So I'm thinking that the Fed raises rates 3 times this year. I think that the economy, in my mind, is showing a lot of late cycle symptoms. For example, the 12-month moving average of non-farm payrolls peaked 2 years ago, 2015. Auto sales, actually, we're getting auto sales today, but the 12-month moving average of auto sales also seems to be rolling over. Credit card delinquencies are going up, also characteristics of late cycle. And so I think a combination of the late cycle and this, I think people putting too much credence into the fiscal stimulus. You know, when Clinton raised taxes in the early 90s, people said this was going to drive the economy into recession, and it didn't. Now people say, well, the Treasury is going to be spending, government's going to be spending more money, this is going to lift the economy. Maybe it doesn't. And so maybe it doesn't fit that much. And so I want to see the economy prove itself. And so I'm still leaning towards the 3 hikes. And I think the 4 hikes are possible. The other problem that we have is sort of the mechanics of it. Right now, the Federal Reserve has only raised interest rates during the 5 times that they've raised rates at a meeting in which there's a press conference. Right now, there's only a press conference in 4 of the meetings. So if the Fed wanted to raise rates, say, 5 times, it has to change its current, like, modus operandi. And I think if it wanted to raise rates 4 times, while it wouldn't have to change its communication style, it really would. There's no room for error. That is to say, there's 4 meetings, if there's press conferences, room for 4 hikes. But if you miss one of them because of something of no like substantive meaning or monetary policy like equity market meltdown like in 2015 and disrupted the markets, something that owing nothing to the Fed policy or even the U.S. economy, some shock could prevent the Fed from doing a 4th time or maybe not doing it in 1 month and wanting to do it a different month. And I think the communication style would have to change to allow that.
Mark, we're in a late business cycle, and at least for the first time in my career, this is very unusual that you're getting this kind of stimulus, either with tax cuts or business spending. Do you think they will be strong enough to overcome 3 rate hikes coming from the Fed, or possibly 4?
Well, so yeah, I don't think that the economy is as sensitive to interest rates as it might seem. I just think that right now, at least, we've been expanding a relatively slow expansion, but it's fairly long. While the expansion can continue, I would sort of penciling in late 2019, early 2020 to either have a growth recession or an outright contraction, just in time for the 2020 election.
So in your terms, describe a growth recession for our listeners, because when you think of a recession, you think of an economy that's contracting, you think of a jump in unemployment. It's something that, well, we've seen 2 of them. We saw one in 2000. Another recession started in 2007, and it wasn't a pretty picture for the markets or the economy.
I'm thinking like a growth recession. What I mean by that is, it's funny about this word recession. There's no really agreed upon definition. There's some rules of thumb, like, say, 2 quarters of contracting GDP. But the U.S. does not really use that definition. The NBER, which defines the recession, typically does not simply use GDP, but a broader range of indicators. But by growth recession, I mean that a recession that would prevent the Fed from continuing to raise interest rates. I mean an economy that's not stagnant, but nearly so. So if right now the U.S. economy trend growth is around 1.8% to 2%, U.S. economy growing above there. But if we go back, say, below trend growth, below 2%, I'd say that would, for a couple of quarters, I'd say that would qualify for me as a growth recession. But in a bigger picture, I want to say that, you know, we did have this horrible financial crisis, but I want to suggest to you that the Great Moderation, which is what we call this period in which, say, from the early 80s to roughly, whether it's 2000 or 2007, where you have relatively longer business cycles and flatter. That is the amplitude of the business cycle, not as high highs, not as low lows. Now, the great financial crisis disrupted that, but and I feel kind of awkward saying this because I sort of feel like that old story about asking Mrs. Lincoln how she liked to play anyways, is that I kind of think that the great moderation is still intact. Despite the great financial crisis, those forces that led to slow growth, subdued inflation, seem to me to really remain intact now.
So, given this, what are your expectations? In your views, you think the dollar is probably going to head higher. What are your views about the market, given all this?
Yeah, so I'm watching the stock market, of course, like many of your listeners, very closely. And I was sort of taken back by the big sell-off, of course, last month. But I like the fact that we recovered smartly, and we retraced more than that Fibonacci 61.8%. I like the fact that after a outside down day last week, there was no follow through the downside. And even after, you know, we did see a reversal that would have been on Tuesday this week, another outside down day, follow through a little bit on Wednesday, a little bit late yesterday, and a little bit more today. But yeah, we're holding this area, another key Fibonacci area, is around, call it 2690 to 2700. You know, Jim, I'm very honest with you when I tell you about what I'm doing with my own personal account. I think that it's both an example of what not to do and an example of what to do sometimes. And at the end of last year, maybe it was around late August, early September, my own personal account, my 401k here at the bank, was up about 13% for the year. So I went to about 70% cash, thinking that the market's overvalued. I was happy with my return for the year. I was happy with that return for even if it's 18 months, if I had to be in the cash. But when the stock market sold off, and I like that price action on, it was right before the 9th we made the low. I wasn't sure it was the low, but the next day when we had that follow through, I put about a third of the money that I took out of the stock market back to work into the market. And I also, this non-retirement money, I sort of jazzed it up a little bit, that is taking a little bit more risk, buying two companies that I thought were badly beaten up. These aren't recommendations, but I tell you what I did. I added on to my GE position, which I'm underwater in. And I also bought some Deutsche Bank stock, which I thought was badly beaten up. And I thought that with the given the size of it and given Jeremy behind it, I thought that the stock had already been beaten up pretty bad, that maybe there was some value down here. So that's what I did. I put a third of my cash back to work, and I bought some assets in my own personal account that I thought were, not my non-retirement account, that I thought were taking advantage of a value opportunity.
Well, certainly some good advice in a market that's overvalued. Mark, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So probably the best place to follow me would be on my blog called Mark to Market, Mark with a C. Mark to Market. And I'm on Twitter as well. I've been using Twitter a bit more. My handle there is Mark Making Sense, which comes from my first book called Dollar Making Sense. I did come out with a new book last year called Political Economy of Tomorrow, where I found this guy who worked at Brown Brothers, the same bank I work at. Back in 1911, 1912, he was an employee. And he had this vision for what how capitalism works. And the problem, I might say, he anticipated both the secular stagnation story from Lawrence Summers, as well as the Keynesian fiscal stimulus in 1911, 1912. Actually, he did that kind of work a decade earlier, right around the turn of the century. So that's a book called Political Economy of Tomorrow.
It was indeed another volatile week in the markets, which seemed to kick off with testimony by the new Fed chair, Jerome Powell, on Capitol Hill on Tuesday and then subsequently on Thursday. He said he has greater confidence in the economy, which has increased since December, and the market took that as an idea that he might be raising interest rates again to slow things down to prevent inflation. So that's the first part of the big picture coming up next. We'll examine exactly what it was the Fed chair said, what it means for the markets, and how investments should go. Also, we'll touch on the subject of oil. There's a lot of complacency out there in the oil market, but perhaps a lot of that complacency is misplaced. All of that coming up next on the Big Picture as a part of the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.